Virginia Woolf once wrote, "Thus, when I come to shape here at this table, between my hands, the story of my life, and set it before you as a complete thing, I have to recall things gone far, gone deep, sunk into this life or that, and become part of it." Well, that's exactly what my guest today on the program has done. His new memoir goes far, it goes deep, and in many ways, it's still going. I'll explain in a minute. I'm Alex Green, and this is Stereo Embers, the podcast. Check this out. Beautiful songs ever written. That is the music of Roxy Music, a band which features my guest today on the program, Phil Manzanera. Let me tell you a little bit about Phil Manzanera. Well, it would take a book to tell you a little bit about Phil Manzanera, and lucky for us, there is one. Yes, the London-born guitarist and producer Phil Manzanera is part of one of the greatest bands of all time. That really isn't the story. It's just part of it. Like 10% of it. Which is crazy when you think of the cultural impact of Roxy Music, but the fact is, Manzanera has lived an interesting life that goes far beyond his tenure in an influential rock and roll band. His book, Revolución to Roxy, explains everything, and after you hit the first chapter, you'll see his origin story isn't a simple one. He covers being multiracial, traveling around the world as a kid and witnessing actual revolutions in Cuba and Venezuela, being sent to a posh boarding school, and the sudden death of his father. And all that happened before he was 15. An old story is, a guy picks up a guitar and his life changes, and that's for sure a big part of the story here. But the longtime history buff only started to understand why he was drawn to music in the first place years later. It turns out that Manzanera is a direct descendant of an Italian opera singer. Oh, and a Jewish pirate. I'm not joking. The cool thing is, the more he digs, the more answers start to show up, and all those answers begin to form an historical Polaroid that's still coming into focus. Revolución to Roxy is a brilliant read, filled with narrative velocity and authorial poise, but it's also the story of a guy who's figuring out who he is in real time. And the reverse engineering is as surprising to him as it is to us. For example, his dad worked for the British Overseas Airway Corporation. Or did he? Being drawn to music was free will. Or was it? You get the idea. Revolución to Roxy is a marvelous blast of biography and self-examination, and it really explores the idea that history is shooting through our DNA. And even if you ignore it, one day it's going to tap you on the shoulder and point you north. Or south. Or it already has and you didn't even know it. This is a great conversation, and Phil is the coolest guy. So here you go. Me and Phil Manzanera of Roxy Music having a conversation right here on Stereo Embers, the podcast.
Where I've done pretty much all my recording for the last 4 years. I do have a proper recording studio in London, but because of COVID, and then I now find it very much easier for me to record with just one amp, one microphone, Logic on my own, and I can spend like hours not ruining everyone else's life.
Is it also a little more efficient to do it that way?
It is, because you're not having to say, oh, can you go back and just do that? And I have a process now where I will put up a track. Say, for instance, I'm working on a track now, funny enough, that Brian Ferry sent me a few weeks ago, which we had started writing in 2005. He said, can you put some guitars on? And I thought, hang on, I've done it about 8 times. Okay, yeah, sure, I'll do it again, whatever. And then I found it much easier. I just put it on the track and I do about like 10 takes and then I go looking for gold, panning for gold, as I said, trying to find little bits that will work and gradually get towards what is new and interesting for a track. And so that you know, I can do that. It's all quiet here. I'm in the garden. Hey.
Why not?
Yeah.
A song from 2005. Did you remember what it was? Where did this come from?
Yeah, I mean, it was a co-write. We co-wrote. But it was going to be on, we attempted to do a Roxy Music album in 2005 with Eno and with the original producer. And it just didn't work out. We realized it didn't work out. So we've had these tracks sitting in our computers ever since, you know, and it's just trying to sort of crack the puzzle, you know, to get it somehow, make it good and interesting and new, you know, so it's work in progress.
Yeah. I loved your book. I one of the things that really struck me was how well curated your life was photographically. You had the ephemera, yeah, the photographs. And I thought to myself, how did you, it's almost like you knew your whole life you were going to be writing this book, because you had all this great chronicling of your days as a human being on this planet. It seems like you didn't throw anything away. How did you have access to so much cool stuff?
Well, for a start, my dad, you know, in the 50s, he had a movie camera, Super 8 camera. He had a Leica camera, a stills camera. He had super duper radio, Zenith radio, and another high-powered radio. He took pictures. And, you know, so those pictures of me dressed up as Zorro in the garden in Havana, that's him. He's taking pictures and, all the pictures. And some of the pictures I took off Super 8 movies that he had done. But, you know, that's what led me to think, hang on, how come he's got all this gear, you know, and a tape recorder. He had a Telefunken tape recorder. And I thought, well, I didn't think of anything about it at the time, but, you know, once I started doing the book and everything and realized where we lived and who he worked, the contacts, and investigating in the public records, you know, I'm beginning to think that he was part of Secret Service, MI6. Yeah, but, I mean, that's, you know, those are archives still closed. You know, there's no access to that. You know, you can't go and find out. But there's so many little clues I found. And, you know, when you basically, you know, you do a memoir, it's different from an autobiography. An autobiography sort of like is every chapter and verse of everything you've done. It was just like a selection of memories. So, and stories and anecdotes that I thought might be funny or witty or give some insight into and make sense for me of what happened, A, in the last 52 years of being a musician, which seemed to have gone very quickly, and also then digging back really for my cousins, which I did this for, you know, I have 50 in Colombia, my brother and sister, my kids, my grandchildren, just to give an idea of where we came from and just put something down on the page, which, you know, I wish my dad would have done that. I would be fascinated to know what he got up to. And I think a lot of families, you know, when you get to a certain age and you either have the opportunity to talk to your parents or they're gone, and you think, I wish I'd actually asked them what it was like or get more a sense of what they felt and about us little brats growing up, or, you know, were they worried for us? You know, that it's that kind of thing. So, you know.
What I love about the book, I read a lot of rock and roll books, as you can imagine. They're behind me on the shelf. And what I love about yours is that there's this discovery happening with every chapter. It's like almost like you're reverse engineering and figuring things out. Things are dawning on you as you're writing, like in real time. And so you've got these two narratives, one of like the past that happened and then how it makes sense to you as a person now, which I thought you just did really well.
No, thank you. I still am. I mean, you know, there's a chapter about my mother's side of the family, you know, which goes back, starts in 1492. Well, a month ago, I was in Curaçao, the Dutch Antilles, looking for my grandparents, my great-grandparents, my great-great-great-great-grandparents, their gravestones, and I found them. You know, so that's not in the book. This is still ongoing. You know, I haven't discovered who my Italian opera musician grandfather is yet, or was, or, you know, that's work still in, it's still work still in progress, you know.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because I'm Jewish. I didn't know there were Jewish pirates, first of all. And you know,
I mean, who knew? I mean, I didn't know. I mean, you know, I've had a lawyer in England, a showbiz lawyer called John Cohen for, you know, I've known him for like 50 years. And when I discovered this, I said, you're not going to believe this, John, but I'm related to one of the most famous Jewish pirates of the Caribbean. He said, what? What are you doing? I said, also, your name's Cohen. Actually, on my mother's side, I'm Cohen Enriquez. You know, and, you know, it was just like we laughed a lot. And he's into like theater and stuff. I said, there's a musical in this. Surely there's a musical, a theatrical musical. But yeah, I was like digging back and going through ancestry.com and looking at all the names, and it was going back and back, you know, 18th century, 17th century, blah, blah, blah. And then I saw this name. I thought, I'll just Google Cohen Enriquez. Well, Moses Cohen Enriquez has his own little Wikipedia page. And I was like looking at the screen and saying, I don't believe this. I do not believe this. And the great thing is, you know, that the story, as it says, it, you know, can you believe everything that's right? The story is that he attacked a big Spanish convoy of galleons carrying gold from Mexico off the coast of Havana, nicked all the gold bullion, which is the equivalent of like something like $9 billion in today's money. Scarpered, went off to Brazil, bought himself an island. Then the Portuguese turn up to conquer and take over Brazil. So he has to get the hell out of there and ends up in Jamaica as the right-hand man of Captain Morgan, the most famous British stroke Welsh pirate of the Caribbean. You know, there's all this famous Morgan's rum and, you know, Captain Morgan's rum. And they never catch him. And he has the biggest bounty on his head, because the Spaniards are furious, you know, he's nicked all their gold, you know. And I just laughed and I thought, wow, who knew? And then I found a little picture, and it's actually a painting, and it's too late to put in the book, but I've got it, and there it is. And we looked at it and we thought, you know what? He looks like I looked when I first joined Roxy, with a big beard and like the long hair and boots. Thought, oh, this is like, you know, it's as if I'm making all this up. You know, it's like, hang on, no one's going to believe it. That's why, you know, the Spanish version came out in last October and in Spain and South America. And the reviewer said, well, this reads more like a Cervantes Don Quixote type 17th century novel, you know, rather than, you know, a rock and roll guitarist, you know, as a memoir.
Yeah, and that's what I mean about it's almost like in real time, it's still unraveling. In the book, you even say, like, you know, we haven't even figured out yet. We have to go to the synagogue and present this thing. It's still unfolding that we have to kind of verify.
And right? We went to the actual synagogue, and it's the first one in the Western Hemisphere that's in Curaçao, you know, and I went to the records office there, and it's all down there, you know, and I needed to get a certificate because, and it's all tied in with Brexit in England, because what happened when we left the European community, I was sitting down one day and I opened the Times newspaper and it said, if you could prove that you had Sephardic Jewish ancestry, either Spanish or Portuguese, you could get a passport, a Spanish or Portuguese passport. And, you know, that means that then you could get into Europe easily. So, of course, everyone was like, I must have. And then that's when all the discovery, you know, went on. And if 3 weeks ago I got a certified certificate from the elders, certified by the public notary in Curaçao, yes, and that I could then apply for a Portuguese passport.
It's like you're officially on the team.
Yeah, and so many of my cousins in Colombia want to do that, and other, you know, other people, they're all doing it, you know, because they're so pissed off the fact that that Brexit happened, you know.
What made you dig so much? Because it seemed, on paper, it probably seemed like, well, my mom is from Colombia, my father's from here, that seems like settled law. What made you keep digging and be so curious about the past?
Well, my mom was born in Barranquilla, Colombia, of 8 siblings. The very last one only died last year, my uncle Tito. And so I had an opportunity to talk to them about how they grew up and my grandma, their mother, and stuff like that. And then he started saying, oh, I think, you know, they all came over at the end of the 19th century to what they used to call Gran Colombia, which is Panama, Venezuela, Colombia. Because once the Spanish were defeated by Simón Bolívar, then Jewish people could come into South America because, you know, Spain wouldn't allow that before. So I thought, oh, well, I love history. So I started saying, well, if that happens to that, and then the Brexit thing really spurred me on, you know. And then I started digging, and it was like all these things started happening, you know. And as I say in the book, you know, when I was 40, my English aunt said, before I die, I've got to tell you, your cousins aren't your cousins, your uncles not your uncles. Your grandmother had an affair with an Italian opera musician in 1911, and your dad was the product of that. What? You know, so it's like the things that you thought were your foundation suddenly disappeared. So you think, well, of course, when she said that to me, I said, wow, that's incredibly exciting. How fantastic, much more interesting than what I thought it was, you know. And then obviously my musician side, that's probably where the DNA, you know, genes come from. There are lots of programs on the TV here about who do you think you are, where they go and investigate people's backgrounds and they come up with extraordinary things. You know, when you start going back and back and you find out where you started from, it's just one of those things that when you get a bit older, you think, yeah, I want to know.
It also plays with that sort of philosophical idea of free will, where you think, like, the story about how you fell in love with guitar at such a young age and bought one, you know, when you were in private school overseas. It also makes you think, like, that wasn't an accident. It was almost like it was preordained.
Well, yeah. And I mean, the guitar that my mum bought in Havana in 1957 and started to teach me is here with me every day.
Oh, that's it.
That's it.
Whoa.
It's very, it's out of tune. It's very nostalgic. And I keep these things around me. This, for instance, is the epaulette of one of Batista's chief of staff, his dinner jacket that I took through his from his looted house in 1959. So I'm sort of encased with, you're right, I do have a lot of stuff, you know. It's probably not good, probably not healthy. But I also have lots of Roxy stuff as well, memorabilia and stuff like that. It helps, you know, when I was writing the thing, or trying to remember things, if I have a picture, like but for some reason I took a picture when Brian Eno left Roxy after his last concert. I have a picture of him waving goodbye, you know, in a field. I mean, obviously coming to use that like 50 years later was just like a head job, mind-blowing thing, you know.
It's a poignant picture.
Yeah, it is a poignant picture, actually, because it was a poignant moment, you know.
Yeah, I love the idea that there's this sort of being a musician was that was just going to happen based on your roots and based on, and now you know that, where it's sort of like this wild rock and roll life that you embarked on. It was almost like it was hardwired into you and you didn't even know it.
No, you didn't know it. No. And you're just rambling along. And it makes you, it is that whole thing of it, you know, are things predestined? Can you change your, what's going to happen in your life? I like to believe that you can, but let's face it, all this, even like when I talk about production and producing people and everything, it's just a question of, do I do this or do I do that? And you make a decision, yes or no? No. Okay, if I'd say no, what then? The next thing, you answer the next question, do I do that or that? And you just head off, series of yes or no's, you know. What I realized through growing up in the 60s in England, and the whole, everything, social change here and in America, everywhere, and the thinking that was going on and the liberation, so it was about freedom. It was about freedom of thought. Okay, call me an old hippie. I was like totally bought into the whole ideal of fairness. Hey, man, yeah, it's cool, you know, like... You know, it might sound a bit naive now, but that informed and has informed everything, you know. And the reason I wanted to be a musician was to be free and not to be controlled by a multinational company or anybody. And, you know, I've managed to sort of do that, get myself out of those kind of situations. And, you know, own the means of production, not having to go and ask permission to go and make music. So I realized that early on through studying at school and reading Karl Marx and Engels. Oh, right. Own the means of production. Yeah, I get it. You know, it's quite a socialist type of thing, but, you know, it's not a political thing. But I picked and chose stuff from here, and I wanted to be with people who were like thought along a similar way and sort of have musical conversations with other musicians from all different countries.
The way you were raised with your father's job, moving around the way that you did, really probably prepared you for the itinerant rock and roll lifestyle of we're going here and there. And you were probably, I'm just assuming this, Phil, but you were probably already comfortable in the world to move like that. Whereas some people, it really can throw young musicians off. Traveling so much can be incredibly taxing for them in ways they hadn't anticipated. But for you, you were already a citizen of the world. You'd moved around so much. Am I right? Did that help you?
I think it did, because obviously I started traveling on planes, you know, since I went to Cuba in 1957. So I've been on every iteration of plane. That's why I'm so into planes, you know. I think I've got a couple of them back there. The models of the planes actually went on in, from 1957, the Stratocruiser, then Britannia, the Boeing 707, the VC-10, you know, everything. I've been on the Concorde. Yeah, I love planes and I love traveling, and it probably is. It's in my DNA somehow. And so, yeah, when I went on tour with Roxy to America, the first American tour, well, sure, it was great and exciting to be in a rock and roll band touring in 1972. But, you know, I'd been there in New York, you know, in 1959.
Right.
You know, I had been with American kids in Venezuela when they came back for their vacations and things. And I had sampled the American way of life in Hawaii and places like that. And you know, I remember passing through San Francisco on the way to Hawaii, you know, getting, you know, so, and yeah, I guess I had a lot of air miles under my belt already before joining Roxy. So I just jumped in. And then all that touring we did in the early years and stuff was wonderful.
Did you feel you were more well-adjusted in that regard than the other guys in the band?
I never thought about it, actually. And I haven't, and you know, you mentioning it now, it's something that perhaps I'll ask them when I see them. And just, it's the kind of question, you know, when you're trying to make sense of this, I had no idea whether, how they felt about that at all. You know, guys, terrible like that. They don't really talk about their feelings and things like that. We know that. It's a bit of a joke, really. I'm always being told, you know, we like gear and sort of like, or sport or something. We go to a bar, we'll talk about sport or, yeah, cars or something. You know, it's not like, you know, wonderful women. We talk about feelings and emotions and everything. We're like little, like, puppies, really, sort of, you know, give us a bone, you know.
That's where we hide.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking, you were saying that those guys are a little bit older than you. They seemed more established in their lives. You were younger. But I thought to myself, yeah, but you have a huge advantage, because I think that you were probably more seasoned as a person on the planet than they were at such a young age.
Well, you know, they also, people also say that if you speak a foreign language, if you, you know, you have a duality. Which, you know, I learned, I was sent to a Cuban school when I was seven. Within 3 months, I could speak Spanish. I've always spoke Spanish. They say that you're more empathetic because you sort of dip into the two different cultures. And, you know, the Latin culture is so different to the British culture. And, you know, when I become a different person, all my hand movements change when I'm speaking Spanish or I'm talking to Latin people. And we laugh and a lot. And the British side is quite reserved and cool, but, you know, just a bit square as well, you know. So, yeah, so, you know, hey, I'm still thinking about all this.
Being half Colombian and half British, did you feel that you were kind of caught in the middle? And if so, was there an identity crisis that you were dealing with?
Well, no, I seem to be able to change from one scenario to another without any problem at all. So, you know, the halfway point is people who speak Spanish and English. We call it Spanglish. You know, so a couple of words would be in English, a couple in Spanish. And, you know, I never felt, I did, you know, when I came to England originally and to this school, the boarding school and everything, it was like a totally different world for me. It was very British. They called public school. We wore pinstripe trousers, shirts with stiff collars, a cap. I thought it was hilarious. It's great, like dressing up. You know, it's like I was in Zorro, dressed as Zorro in Havana. Now I'm dressed as an English public school boy in England. It didn't work. It was just part of the fun, you know. I didn't think further than that, you know. obviously when you're little, you don't really, you just do it, you know, you do it without thinking about that. But and the thing about being half South American, well, now I realize quarter South American, quarter Italian, quarter everything, is that in the 70s when I started in rock, nobody was interested. No one ever asked me a question about my background in 10 years in Roxy, you know, because they were only interested, focused in, you know, English avant-garde pop art or, you know, all that kind of thing. There wasn't really interest in anything from other countries. It was very insular. And really, it took someone like Peter Gabriel to sort of break the mold in terms of getting people interested in music from other countries. And of course, the Buena Vista Social Club when they came out. And that was, you know, only in the 90s, I think. Yeah. It was in the late 90s. When that all happened and it was huge, I said, well, hang on. When I was seven, I saw them in the Tropicana Club in Havana when they were at their prime. Nobody asked me, no one was interested, you know. I've been doing this for years, you know, whatever. But, you know, you just get into a perception. People have a perception of you and what they want to think about you, you know. And I guess what's been interesting in bringing out this memoir is that people said, well, God, I had no idea of the backstory. And I find when I've read different people's rock biographies, most interesting part for me is the early bit before they become famous or get into a band, because then it's pretty much the same thing. Then we did a tour, then we played at Madison Square Gardens, then we made a record, then the record came out, and I've read that so many times. But after I read about their childhood, personal things, I tend to get a little bit bored, you know, because I've heard all those stories before. I didn't want to have too many of those kind of stories. And then we did this, and then we did that, and you know, then we came back from tour, and we went from tour.
Because the origin story, it's like the journey is more interesting than the destination, right? The origin story, how the connective tissue connected, is fascinating.
Yeah. No, I was listening to a podcast, funny enough, today, I didn't know it existed, between Elton John and Joni Mitchell, where she really opened up about stuff and about the songs and about her background, put it in a context that was fascinating, you know, because we've heard the music and we've listened to the songs lots of times and everything, but to have somebody put it into some sort of life context is sort of interesting.
From an ethnic standpoint, someone like Freddie Mercury is a really great example almost of how a rock god can almost transcend his ethnicity. Like, I don't think he looked at Mercury and thought, I wonder where that guy is from. He was just a deity, where it almost like just crushed all borders and all thoughts of race or heritage. He was just this kind of rock god. Because the reverse engineering now, you realize, oh, you look at his roots and you go, oh, he was an ethnic male. And no one knew that really at the time or thought about it.
Nobody even thought about it, no. And, you know, in the context of what's going on in the UK and everything, which the UK has a very multiracial, the biggest multiracial society in the world, actually, I suddenly thought, well, hang on, my mother's Colombian, I'm British. I'm sort of mixed race. You know, that idea of mixed race. And the more you go back and through history and everything, we discover how many of us are totally mixed race. Actually, it sort of like expands the whole meaning of what that word, that phrase has become. But, you know, when as it relates to music, you know, you're trying to sort of work out, well, why is that person's music turning out like that? And then you understand it a bit more when you know where they come from, what they listen to. And can help with the appreciation of the of people's music, you know.
Did you ever cross paths with Freddie?
No, but by some bizarre thing, I've had the same accountant for the last 50 years.
Wow.
Who does his estate now. So I do know a lot about him. I'd met Brian May a few times, and it was just brilliant. I loved him, yeah.
What about your concept of home? I mean, for someone who moved around so much and then traveled so much with the band, and, you know, buying a home early on in your life, which is considered early now, your concept of home, was that something that you felt was pretty fixed in your brain, the idea of settling somewhere, or did you see the world as your home? I know it sounds like a cliche, but...
No, I never saw the world as my home. Because everything was so like established on shifting sand, if you like, the movement, my father dying when I was 15, you know, being at school in South, being a boarder at the school in South London, and then joining a band where it was all like, whoa, what's happening here? You know, the success and then the touring. I needed to I needed some stability. I got married very early and I bought a house very early, you know, like age 21. I needed some roots or some base to go to. So I can see why that happened then, you know, and, you know, people or kids and stuff now, they're not kids, they're adults. They wait much, much longer to get married to buy property, you know, it's all like 10 years later than my generation, which was like the condition to do things by the age of 21 or something like that, like much earlier. Everything has sort of shifted, you know.
Are you still a curious traveler? Are there places you haven't been that you'd like to go?
Actually, there aren't. I have been to quite a lot of places.
No one says that, Phil.
I know not to go to certain places just because of my health now. For instance, I can't go back even to places of high altitude because, you know, like, unfortunately, I have a lot of cousins in Bogota. It's very high altitude. I'm never going back there. If I want to see cousins, things, they have to come to the coast in Cartagena or Barranquilla. I can't sort of going back to Mexico City. It's too high. I go to Oaxaca or to the, you know, the other lot, the other places, and also there's certain countries I know I will get ill instantly because I have a so I haven't been to, apart from being at the airport in India, I'll never go to India because I know I'm the guy who will get a bug, and it'll probably kill me. I did go to Burma and came back, and I think I had sepsis. Actually, or Myanmar, as they call it. So I thought, you know what, at this point, I think, you know, just go to the places that you really like.
No one ever says there's nowhere else I'd like to go, which means, you know, you've lived a pretty satisfying life of travel.
I've ticked quite a lot of boxes in terms of travel before joining Roxy and then after joining Roxy. So between all those places, you know, I do love looking at the globe and looking at maps and things like that. But as of today, I can't identify somewhere that I'd love to go to that I haven't been to.
Your time in Hawaii, did you, that sort of that guitar music, that slacky guitar stuff in Hawaii, did that appeal to you at all? And does it show up in your work?
Well, strangely enough, I loved, yeah, Hawaiian music. And, of course, it's the electric Hawaiian guitar, that sound. I loved it. And, in fact, the B-side of the second Roxy Music single ever, the single was called Pajama Rama, and the B-side is called Hula Kula. And it's me playing a Hawaiian instrumental with Brian and Andy and Eno playing gazoos on top of it. Slightly comedic sort of thing. But yeah, so that was totally because of me living in Hawaii. And when it came to doing, you know, that's my first track, Roxy track. I thought, yeah, dig into my past. Nobody else is going to do a Hawaiian instrumental. Hula Kula, it's called.
I'm a huge Split Enz fan. And I think the Thin Brothers are just magic. I just think those guys are just ridiculous. Yeah. I know the record you produced, Neil wasn't around on that album, right?
Well, he wasn't on the album, but he did come over. And at that point, he was too young to be in the band because he's only 16. And they sent him to me because he had been used to playing acoustic guitar all the time to have some sort of electric guitar lessons. Well, lessons, you know. I remember setting up like a big high wire stack, getting my Firebird out and being in this like winter garden place in the house that I had, and him turning up and God knows what. I mean, he remembers that. Actually, I saw him play Neil Finn a couple of years ago here at Hampton Court Palace, and he was totally brilliant. And afterwards, he said, "Isn't this near where you used to live when I came over?" I mean, wow, what a talent. I mean, I saw him at the when we did the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame thing, and he was there with Fleetwood Mac. And at that time, he was singing from Fleetwood Mac. The guy, I mean, those brothers, they just got it. It's been such a treat to know them since 1975. And then lucky enough to do, during lockdown, like 2.5 albums with Tim. And, you know, the guy, I can't praise them enough, really. I just adore them. And I have played on stage a few times with them. I happened to be in LA when they were mixing Woodface. Mm. And they were using Bob Clearmountain, who's the guy who did the Roxy stuff, and I went to the studio and thought, "Oh, this is good." And they said, "Oh, we're going to do a little MTV show at a club around the corner. Do you want to come along?" I said, "Do you want to come on stage?" So I came and joined in. And then suddenly, without them telling me, they started playing "Love Is the Drug," the Roxy song. They were so funny, you know, that Crowded House band. And at that point, you know, Tim was in it too. You know, but so there's a lot of history, you know, when they came to London and we did the demos, and then we re-recorded the first album. And then, you know, they turned up at just when punk was happening. So it was tricky for them. But they were wonderfully like weird and wacky. And but eventually, you know, they just couldn't make ends meet and they were like destitute. And in fact, the session money from them singing on one of my solo albums, K-Scope, paid for their air flights to get back to New Zealand. And then the rest is history, because they wrote then a whole bunch of hits, and then they gradually went up and up and up and up, and then Crowded House happened, and they went even further up. During the Fleetwood Mac tour, Neil got to sing and play Don't Dream It's Over with an acoustic guitar. And I can't remember, Stevie Nicks backed him as well. It was a magic moment. I remember Wembley Stadium, him just singing and playing that. And I just thought, oh, this is great song, beautifully sung, simple, two acoustic guitars. Wow.
As a young fledgling, was it pretty clear that Neil Finn had something? Could you tell he was talented pretty early on?
Well, no, I didn't know that then. No, not at all. I mean, I knew Tim, being an elder brother and was the lead singer, had a beautiful voice. Mm. And I thought, you know, he's as good a singer as Elton John. This guy, you know, is incredible. He sat at the piano as well and did amazing tunes and things. But you don't think that way at the time. And of course, I realize now that we were quite similar in age, you know, me and Tim. Not me and Neil, but Neil was just like a starting, you know. He didn't know that potential was in there, you know, that would blossom up.
And you and Tim are very close. You guys are clearly close friends.
Yeah, absolutely adore the guy. Yeah, I mean, he did say, do you fancy doing some gigs? And I said, yes, please. And it was going to happen this summer, but I don't think it will. But maybe it might happen next year. And it would be great. He still is up for doing it. And I would love to do it too, together. Yeah.
My perception of you is that you're an easy guy to work with. Do you think that's true? And what do you think the secret is to being a good collaborator?
You're right. People have mentioned in the reviews that, and in interviews, that I seem to be collegiate, which seems like a good word. I know Robert Wyatt's wife called me a facilitator in the nicest possible way. I think empathy is the thing. When I was talking about, you know, the thing that people who speak two languages meant to be more empathetic, I can see another point of view. But fundamentally, you know, one of the reasons I became a musician is to the social side of being in the company of other people, getting to know new people, working together. Again, it goes back to that sort of hippie thing. I thought, you know, and also along the way, the good friends I've had have like said to me, you know, when I was younger, Phil, think conceptually, think about context. And so if I produce or work with other people, I tend to say, well, what are we doing here? What are we trying to achieve? You know, why are we doing this? You know, so once you plant those questions, it sort of starts a dialogue. And then it's a series of decisions. Should we do this? Should we do that? And, you know, as a working with other people as a producer or something, I can say, they'll tell me what they're going to do. I say, well, that's great. It's either great or you could do this as well or that. Do you want to try that or that? You know, it depends how open they are. If they're not that open, then why do you need somebody to produce? You know, otherwise you just get an engineer and do it yourself. A lot of people like to have somebody to bounce their ideas off, you know, especially artists, musicians, you know. So, you know, I have a palette of music that I can draw upon, you know, everything from systems, electronics, jazz, classical, rock, pop, you know, so I can sort of get an overview and analyze particular music. And I can spot a good tune, obviously, and whether something's a hit or not, or it doesn't need to be a hit, it doesn't want to be a hit, but it's great as well. It's an honest reflection of, and it's going to create some resonance in the listener. You know, so there's all sorts of things that go on in my brain that I think, you know, probably... And also it's experience. You know, I've been in so many different musical settings, from, you know, the most free-form type of jazz or electronic to more conventional song type structures and things like that.
You've worked with such high-level artists. How do you handle ego when it presents itself and it shows up and it can get in the way of things? How do you deal with that?
If someone's got an ego but doesn't have the chops to actually deserve that ego, then I'm just not having it. Or the arrogance. If it's arrogance in a musical situation, if they think their idea is brilliant, well, the idea is either brilliant or it's not. You know, if everybody thinks it's brilliant, it's brilliant. If half people say, then, you know, that's not brilliant. So, you know, to tell the difference, to have a critical faculty, that's the thing, to be able to say somewhere, he could do better. I phrase it like that. It's great, but I think he can do better. You know, it puts people on the spot, whoever they are. You know, nobody can be brilliant all the time. you know, so everybody, and you know, you recognize that people will also have high points and low points in their careers and dips in their creative dynamic. So, you know, understanding that, it depends, you know, in what capacity you're working with them or meeting them, or, you know, if someone's incredibly good or incredibly talented. No, that's why when I talk about Dylan, you know, I know when I was working with him that he has just done some incredible thing. This guy, I'm going to cut him some slack. He wasn't being arrogant. I think he was just playing with you or whatever. But fundamentally, he's earned the right to do it, you know, up to a certain point. There's a certain point you say, oh, fuck you. It's great, but no, goodbye. You know, but there's very, very few people like that. Very, very few people like that in the whole music. And so it's that thing of having some critical faculties, you know, and getting through all the fame bullshit and stuff like that. You know, it's about the actual work. You know, the quality of the work, you know, the quality of the words, the quality of the melody, the quality of the groove, you know.
Because Dylan is one of the only people who could get away with what he got away with in that chapter, where it's sort of like, is he even going to sing?
Yes, that was, it was, it's very funny looking back on it now, but at the time it was like, oh shit.
Yeah.
What am I going to do?
Well, it's not a book about burning bridges. It's a celebration. And yeah. What I love is that you've maintained all these friendships that you've had for 50 years. And that says a lot, I think, about who you are as a person and who you are as a friend to all the musicians that you've known.
I hope so, because, you know, I want to, you know, not bend with the wind.
Can you tell me, it's a guy I always wanted to talk to, and I can't now because he's gone, but can you tell me how brilliant of a musician John Wetton was? Because I feel like musicians know, but he was one of those under the radar guys where he was absurdly talented, wasn't he?
He was incredibly talented, and even before I met him, I knew he was incredibly talented because I'd heard him play the bass part on a track by a band called Family. And it was a track called Burlesque, which became a single. And I'd never heard anyone in the UK be able to play bass in the way that Larry Graham played in America at the time with Sly and the Family Stone. And I loved that kind of growl on the bass and the way he played it. And John could just play that. Also, he had perfect pitch. He could sing and play a great volume on stage and still stay in tune and play. So technically, he was incredibly proficient, and he could sing. People who can, like McCartney and stuff, who play bass and sing, it's difficult to play. You've got different rhythmic things going on. John could do it. He just had that natural ability. And so we were great, great friends. We got on, went holidayed a lot together. But to a certain extent, he also became a victim of his own success in the sense that he started drinking a lot once Asia became very big. And he'd waited a long time and it became huge. And then the pressures of the whole industry and everything got to him. And it spoiled things, which is such a shame to see. But yeah, wonderful guy, great, you know, great. Fun to be with, and a great, great musician,
like a brilliant technician as a player.
Yeah, I mean, you know, those albums with King Crimson, where he's, you know, singing and playing. I heard a version of what was the track being played live in Central Park. It might be actually on YouTube. The one of the most famous Crimson songs from that. Those first three albums that he did with Fripp and Bill Bruford and stuff. Just absolutely terrific. He nailed that sort of Crimson thing, that next phase of Crimson, totally.
You take notice of bands like the Smiths or the Stone Roses who both had really brilliant guitar players. Did those bands show up on the radar for you at all, or did you not pay attention to them?
Well, Johnny Marr, of course. I mean, the Smiths, they used a guy who was played bass in Roxy to produce their first two albums, and they borrowed my 12-string guitar on the first Smiths album. The first time they appeared on Top of the Pops was playing my 12-string.
No way.
Yeah. No, and that use of tremolo on that famous track, I can't remember the titles.
Oh, How Soon Is Now?
Yeah, How Soon Is Now. That totally is something that we used to do in Roxy. And John Porter set up the, you know, the vibrating. But I mean, obviously, you know, the style that Johnny Marr developed was very unique. And for a three-piece, and that sort of way he played those arpeggios and his sort of minimalist but melodic kind of style was, totally aware of that. Yeah. And because of the connection with John Porter, I'd listened to it right from the beginning. You know.
And you were a fan of those records?
Yeah, absolutely.
I interviewed Paul Carrack, who I know you were talking about getting Paul Carrack for one of your bands at one point. I didn't know he played on the first Smiths album.
No, I didn't either. Did he really?
Yeah. I know.
I'll have to Wikipedia this again and sort of worked out what he played. But yeah, I mean, you know, London wasn't not enormous, not like New York or LA, a number of musicians. So there were a lot of, you tended to meet all these people in quite small circle of musos, you know, round Notting Hill and round Island studios at Basing Street and stuff like that. it doesn't surprise me as well, because John Porter would have known Paul Carrack, absolutely.
You explain in the book that you made more money off of being sampled by Kanye and Jay-Z for that track, yeah. Which I totally get. You said you made more money on that than you did in 50 years in the business. Can you explain, for people who understand, why that was, though? Like, why was that such a profitable track for you?
You know, the whole paradigm of the music industry has changed, you know, in the last 50 years, obviously, how people earn money from records. There are no record shops now. They're streaming. And a lot of pop music and songs are used in films. So when they're used in films, there's this thing called synchronization rights, and film companies pay a lot of money to use certain tracks. And if you have a track that is used on records, but in films as well, and in not only films, but the trailers for films pay something like five times more than just having the song in, then it's like a sort of, you imagine in a casino, you know, the What I'm Bandit thing, the apples and things going around. It's one of those things. Suddenly, you know, oh, it's being used in that, and then the thing goes around. And then it's been used in the ad commercial in the Super Bowl thing. Wow. And then it's used for a car commercial. Then it's used in The Great Gatsby. Then it's used in Safe House with Denzel Washington. And then it's, you know, and it just, things accumulate, you know. And from this tiny little riff that I wrote in 10 minutes watching the television the night before I went in the studio to try and do an instrumental on the same album that actually Tim and Neil Finn were on in 1976. 40 years later, you know, 88 Keys sampled it, slowed it down, which was a genius move on his part, played it to his friend Kanye West. They took it. They wrote a song on it very quickly. Within a week, it was the last song on their album, Watch the Throne. They closed the album, boom, and it was done. And then, you know, then someone rang me and said, "You're on this thing." I said, "You're mistaken, because people always get my name mixed up with Ray Manzarek from the Doors. They said, no, it's you. No, I don't think it is. Okay. We can't send it to you because it's top secret. We'll play it down the phone. And I could hear this thing and I thought, it sort of sounds like me, but it's been slowed down. But it sounds cool. But the one thing that people don't know is that it's not just guitar. I also added at the beginning of every riff a bass harmonica mixed into that sound. So when it slowed down, it acquired another flavor. It's like a combination sound. And so it wasn't just a question of playing a guitar. On the original, I put this harmonica thing on it, which the guys from 10cc had given me, Kevin Gordon and Lowell Green. So it was a weird serendipitous thing that happened. And to me, it's wonderfully random. Anything can happen in the music. You just got to stay in your lane, have good calm, and things can happen. You know, okay, we're going back to the whole sort of hippy-dippy thing again, but it's worked for me.
The funniest thing is you were like, I'm not even sure I remember doing that. And then, you know, when the checks start coming in, you're like, wow, that's,
yeah, I guess. It took quite a long time to come in, and I thought, I'm never going to be paid. And then some guy said, oh, yeah, you know, that label and everything, you need someone to go into Chicago or wherever they are and just pull out a gun and say, give me the money. And they open the drawer and give me this. Oh, yeah, here it is. But for a while, I thought, nah, it's never going to, But then eventually, you know, it was through Universal. So, and actually, the Rockefeller Records were Universal as well. So I managed to get it. But, you know, hey, all musicians have that problem of like, I mean, I've produced a whole bunch of albums on major labels in South America. I've never had a royalty statement. You know, hey, this is what happens. But you just keep going and do more stuff and hope. I mean, bizarrely, like last week, 2 weeks ago, I had a number one album, which was that I produced seven of the 12 tracks of Rod Stewart and Jules Holland, a swing album with a big band. I can't believe that. How did that happen? I did it 2 years ago. It's just
things. Really?
Happen. Yeah. I did it 2 years ago. It's just like only came out 2 weeks ago and it was number one. I mean, it sounds great, but I mean, it's not what maybe people expect that I would have done. And I agree.
These are like late career surprises.
Yeah. I just take a deep breath and stay in my lane. You know, at the weekend, we did three gigs, me, Andy Mackay from Roxy, and Paul Thompson from Roxy. And it's what we brought out an album last year called AMPN, which is like weird instrumental stuff. And we did a live versions of it, which should have been a complete disaster, but it turned out to be incredibly good. And again, we're sort of like scratching our heads and saying, how did this happen? You know, but it's like we're in an avant rock group again, you know, because Roxy started out as the ad that I answered to join. It says, Avant Roxy, Avant Rock Group, like avant-garde, but Avant Rock Group, seek guitarist. So I said on stage, well, hang on, we're back doing what the mission statement said back in 1972. We're being enough. And here we are at our age and we're doing this. And it's going to be different, but hopefully in a good way. And actually did turn about. I mean, we did record it and everything, so people will hear it eventually. It was only in front of like 75 people a night. But it was, I mean, it's music like I've never heard before, quite frankly, some of it.
Are you playing every day? Are you one of those guys where you're not?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, sometimes I look at Fripp's things and he practices like every day and he's just like a master guru. So I don't. I tell you why I don't. And okay, you could say I'm just lazy, but on the other hand, every time I come back to the guitar, having not played it for some time, I really enjoy it. And it's not a chore, and I get lost in it. And I come up with something different. And I decided when I was about 17 or 18, I didn't want to learn too much technique, and I didn't want to learn it. I wanted to spend my whole life playing the guitar and not learn how to do everything, which I never would be able to anyway. But there's still loads of things that I want to learn how to do. And it's like work in progress, you know. But I don't know. In fact, I hadn't played since the farewell tour at a gig or anything till last weekend. So I'm slightly annoyed that Andy insisted that we go out and play, because I'm going to have to learn how to play again. But actually, it was very tiring, but very worthwhile.
Yeah, I mean, you say in the book that you wanted to make sure that you didn't become too technical.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask you, like, how do you avoid that? And I guess the answer is by not having this sort of daily discipline, you can remain kind of rough around the edges, I guess, which kind of keeps it more alive, like alive.
It keeps it fresh, and it keeps you wanting to do it. You know, the thing about guitars and guitarists, that if you get a new guitar, you like want to play it, which is great, you know. And after a while, so you look around. That's why I have the guitars everywhere I am. I've got guitars sitting around and just think, oh, I haven't played that for ages. I'm really going to enjoy playing that, you know. And then, it's sort of mental health in some ways. It's kind of therapy, you know. But, yeah, I know how my style evolved. Now, people might like it, might not like it, but it evolved by me not being able to play properly, by me wanting to learn Crossroads by Cream, and everybody at school, my school, saying, you're playing it wrong, and me saying, I'm trying to get it right, so it's not like that. In the end, saying, I'm just playing it my way. And I thought, okay, this is my way out of like not appearing to be stupid. But in fact, it's helped me to develop some style, you know, of my own that doesn't come directly from a book or watching someone play scales. Or it has to have some sort of meaning and some sound to it, special sound.
But when the guitar is not in your hand and you're living your life, just being a person, does your brain still play around with chords in your head? Are you always sort of playing guitar even if you're not playing guitar?
I can practice guitar like that, but I try not to. I try to listen to other music, so a wide range of music. Music's with me all the time, as it is with so many people and with so many different occasions and stuff. And you just hope that some of it will go in and then come out processed in an interesting way when you go back to the guitar, you know.
In terms of the next year or two or projects that are bubbling, anything you're working on?
There's all sorts of things that are in development. But I've just been through a very busy period with the memoir and then with these gigs. So I'm just chilling and thinking.
I loved your book. And I think, like I was telling you before, I've read so many rock and roll books. Yours is totally different. And I think that your yearning for self-discovery and your interest in identity and how you were formed and how you became the person you were and the choices that you made was just really interesting and really compelling. And I know you were saying, like, people just want to jump to the Roxy Music stuff. I wasn't one of those people. I I wanted to, me, what was before that and what was after that was far more interesting to me, like what you were saying. Did the process of writing the book, just to finish with, what did you, I know it sounds so, it's a silly question, but what did you learn the most about yourself in constructing this narrative?
What I learned is that there's so many areas that I need to discover more about, make sense of still. So it is an ongoing thing. There won't be another version of the book, but in my own quest to find out who I am and where I'm going and where I should go, it's helped a lot. And it's helped with my relationship with my brother and sister, you know, in terms of discussing our life. And also with, you know, it's opened up things with the other members of the band, Roxy, and, you know, the other musicians. You know, it's just like a discussion opener, conversation start, you know, where you can just reflect and try and make sense of things, you know, and be happy.
Which is the most important thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Such a pleasure to talk to you. Congratulations on a book. I know it was not an easy book to write. Your recollections are so almost forensic. Your memory is incredible. The details that you were able to recall, which is why I think people say it reads like an adventure story. It's a brilliant book, Phil. It's really well done.
So much. That's so kind of you. Thanks.
It is really good. It's such a great book. You got to get it. Pick it up. Revolución to Roxy, Phil Manzanera's memoirs. Reads like a novel. And I would say it's one of the best rock and roll memoirs I've ever read. Lovely guy. Very cool dude as well. Pick up your copy. Manzanera.com is where you need to go to grab one, or just get it through your local indie bookstore. Speaking of bookstores and books, AlexGreenBooks.com is where you need to go to find out what's happening in my literary career. My new book, The Adventure Teen All-Stars, is out now in paperback. So grab a copy. It's so portable, you'll want to take it to the beach. I don't know. Or maybe you won't. Maybe when you go to the beach, you just take a bottle of wine. Maybe that's all you need. How about a bottle of wine and the book? We'll make a deal. BombshellRadio.com is where you need to go to find out what's happening with our radio station. Don't forget to follow me on what's left of Twitter, at Embers Editor, or on Instagram at Embers Podcast, or just email me, editor@StereoEmbersMagazine.com. Stereo Embers the Podcast is available on all podcast platforms, just like the one you're listening to right now. Rate and review the program. Tell all your friends. We'd appreciate it. Let's close the show with a longer listen to one of the greatest songs ever written, featuring Phil Manzanera on guitar, Roxy Music, More Than This. Enjoy it. And thank you, as always, for listening to Stereo Embers the Podcast, only right here on Bombshell Radio.